It's kind of like, Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has so much goodwill on its balance sheet just because it's Coca-Cola. Everybody wants a Coke. And why? It's just the way it's always been. Will that be forever? Probably not. And the United States has this incredible soft power. But I think it's very clear that position of dominance is slowly ebbing. And I think that's one of the defining themes, because then you look at the countries that are taking its place.
Global Investor Podcast. The goal of this podcast is to offer investors and entrepreneurs insights and practical advice to dramatically improve the kinds of deals you invest in and the returns you get. My name is James Evenson. I'm one of the partners at Crown Private and our investor syndicate, Obris. Obris is about exceptional people, unique experiences, and bespoke investment. Our membership and community are built up of like-minded, yet unique and adventurous individuals, as well as family offices. We invest in a spectrum of deals ranging from established companies to startups. We do so with a proven formula of due diligence, structuring, and management. I'm very pleased today to be interviewing Kim Iskian. Kim has had quite a diverse career as a global investment analyst and strategist, an investment newsletter publisher, a hedge fund manager, author, and political risk analyst. Kim grew up in Spain, and he's lived in 9 countries, including Sri Lanka, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, for 9 years, and most recently in Singapore, where he launched and headed up a business for investment newsletter for Stansberry Research. He and his family recently moved to Ireland, where Kim is the international editor for Stansberry Research. He also writes for an affiliated magazine called American Consequences. All right. Hey, Kim, welcome. Thanks for joining me today. I've been really looking forward to this interview. In fact, just this morning before we started the conversation, I was reading your article in American Consequences in your Chaos Chronicles about the FBI agent in your living room. So very much looking forward to having this conversation. Let's start with where you're at today. Where do we find you?
James, I am in Dublin in Ireland, just we got here a little bit more than 2 weeks ago, and 2 days ago we finished our 2-week quarantine. So I'm thrilled to be able to go out and about finally.
Wow, that's exciting. What will be your first stop when you head out?
Well, the first stop about 2 days ago was to buy a car.
Okay.
And look for places to live. I'm right now at an Airbnb.
Okay, gotcha. So you're going for the practical over sightings of U2 or a good beer in a pub.
Pubs are closed anyway, so
yeah. Oh my. wow. All right, well hey, I have already told our listeners and our viewers a bit about your background, and I suspect a fair number of them know you from your writing. I'd like to dig into your worldview, how you see the world. You have spent a lot of time in a lot of places over the last 20-ish years. Your entire lifetime. So I'm always interested in how that shapes the individual and what that means to you today. So tell us about that.
Well, James, I grew up in Spain, and I've lived in a total of 8 countries, 9 countries since then, 9 years in Russia, lived in Sri Lanka and Singapore most recently for 5 years. A number of other places. And I think that, as you grow older and you go back to some places and you see how places and people change, there are a few things that kind of stick out to me. And when I was in Madrid in the late 70s and 80s, Spain was a third world country. And the saying was that Europe began at the Pyrenees. And Spain was really cut off from the rest of the world. And that's, you're a kid, you're growing up, you don't really appreciate that, you don't see that. But when I compare what Spain was like then to what it was today, and today Spain is, it's part of Europe. It's one of the, poorer cousins, but it's, no one kind of questions that. No one kind of thinks about that. And it strikes me how quickly kind of our collective societal memory and experience moves on. And I think that's one of the dangers of time, right? Because, for example, the entire generation that experienced World War II has passed away. So all those lessons and all those important things, they've kind of receded to the past. And yeah, historians today know it. And people who are, you know something about history, yeah, they kind of remember it. But you don't have that kind of firsthand experience. I think that's something that I see, you know, obviously not relevant to World War II or anything. But you see what Spain is today. And to me, it's still this, you know, this dusty kind of backwater that I grew up in. That's one thing. Another kind of thing that I've learned, on the one hand, you see how places change and evolve, and then you see how some places just stay the same. When I was in the mid-1990s, I went to Kyrgyzstan, which is a little slip of a country in Central Asia. It's a tongue twister of a country, and unless you really are into your geography, you probably wouldn't have heard about it. But I went there to help build a stock market, because at the time, the US government saw what was happening in what was then just the former mm-hmm. Soviet Union, and how all these former Soviet countries were feeling their way around in the dark, trying to figure out what to do next. And the US government said, well, maybe if we can go into some of these countries and, you know, kind of spray cash and spray American expertise and people, maybe we can hopefully convince these countries not to go back to the dark side, you know, not to revert to communism or whatever, which was never a viable option. But at the time it seemed, well, that could happen. So Kyrgyzstan, this was pretty much pre-internet in a lot of ways, or relatively early internet days. And in Kyrgyzstan, it's just to the west of Northwest China, and it borders Kazakhstan. And it is really in the middle of nowhere. It is so far out, so remote. At the time, we would go to Almaty, which was the capital of Kazakhstan. We would go there for boxed milk. And I was like, whoa, I'm going to get some boxed milk.
Wow.
And that was a three-hour drive.
I can remember that drive. Because I spent a lot of time in Kazakhstan when we crossed over to go to Bishkek, the treacherousness of the roads back then.
Yes. And, you know, the funny thing is, now you go to Bishkek, I was last there 3 or 4 years ago, so not that recently, but I doubt it's changed since then. And it is still the total backwater of a country. It's a beautiful, lovely place, wonderful people, spectacular mountains. But the only thing that's changed is there are more cars and there are more Turkish grocery stores. Otherwise, in terms of evolution, in terms of development, it's kind of like a time capsule, which on the one hand is kind of lovely, but on the other hand, it's so sad that it just hasn't developed. So, you know, you see how things change and then how other things stay the same. And I think that, for one thing, as investors, we want to try to anticipate those places that'll change and anticipate those places that'll stay the same, because, you know, staying the same, maybe it'll improve 30% over the next 10 years, but changes, places that change, you know, they change tenfold over the next 10 years. And that's one of the things that I kind of look for in new markets and new places, to see, okay, are the ingredients in place for genuine wholesale change and improvement to happen? Or is this going to be a very nice place, not to denigrate the location or the anything else? But is it just going to be a less interesting place from an investment perspective for a very long time?
Do you feel like you can predict that?
No.
Can anyone predict that?
No.
Well, my point of reference is, you're talking about Kyrgyzstan, and I haven't been there for several years, but Harris Kupperman was there a couple of years ago, and walked right into the stock exchange, probably the one that you helped set up years ago, and spoke about its condition, which is just like you described, hadn't really progressed. But you go to the country to the west and south of Kyrgyzstan, and what do you have? You have Uzbekistan that sat for close to 30 years with almost no movement. And then the president passed away, and it is, I haven't been there recently, it's been years, but I don't think it's just a veneer of change of, like you said, Turkish grocery stores that have come in. There is genuine change happening there. So in any way to predict which countries are going to be the Spains or the Uzbekistans versus the Kyrgyzstans?
Well, I think Spain, at the time, you probably could have anticipated, because when Spain joined the EU in 1987, that was the beginning of just a flood of investment, a flood of money, a flood of EC, at the time EC money, and tourists and everything else. So it wouldn't, I don't know, I think that one you could probably have seen coming. Mm-hmm. I was 15 or 16 years old, so maybe I can excuse myself for not having planned better. Someplace like Uzbekistan, that it's fascinating because it didn't change for so long. And then when Karimov passed away, the assumption was that Mirziyoyev, the new president, mm-hmm. relatively new, would have everything just tick over. And it turned out that he's actually, seems to be an extraordinary reformer. Who knew? Some things you can't really predict. And other things, with Kyrgyzstan, I mean, they had two bona fide revolutions within a decade, and nothing changed. I think that if you look at geography and you look at demographics, and Kyrgyzstan has a bit of gold, but that's it. Uzbekistan is wildly wealthy. And you look at Kazakhstan to the north, it floats on, oil and gas. You look at human resources, Kyrgyzstan has 5 million people. Uzbekistan has 32 million people. So in terms of being an attractive market that would draw in investment, draw in people from abroad, repats who say, gosh, I could make a fortune here, I should go back. You're going to see a whole lot less of that in smaller countries. It's Monday morning quarterbacking is very easy, isn't it? But
absolutely. Well, let's go back to the question then, and other aspects of how you view the world. This is fascinating so far.
At the other end of the spectrum, I just spent, I lived in Singapore for 5 years, and Singapore is pretty much the height of development. Everything is so incredibly efficient. It's clean, it's safe. It's boring after a while, and it's kind of like Disney meets 1984.
That's a good reference, actually.
If you like history, it's probably not the best place, because everything's knocked down every, couple of decades to make way for something new. I think so often, not so often, but fairly frequently, you read about countries or regions that say, we want to become, quote unquote, the next Singapore. For one thing, trying to imitate someone else's success with that sort of cookie cutter is never going to work. For another thing, I think that when you look at the experience of Singapore, it was a small, very small country geographically, population-wise, and it was in such dire straits. And then it had just a singular leader who said, all right, this is what we're going to do. I think if you have such a unity of purpose and someone who has that kind of vision and that sort of skills to bring together people and say, all right, this is what we're going to do, and then stick with it for decades. It's just not the sort of thing that's replicable. You can take bits and pieces of Singapore, and I think that's what a lot of countries have, what they have done, and try to say, okay, we're going to implement this, we're going to implement that, we're going to improve the professionalism of our civil service, or we're going to try to take corruption and completely make it impossible. So my point here is that there's only so much that countries like Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan, for that matter, can look abroad and say, okay, what worked for other people? Let's try to implement that. And you'll find things, but it's very difficult to transplant entire systems to new places.
I've been active in the Eastern European countries, Eurasian countries for 30 years now. I watched in the 90s how so many countries tried to put their stamp onto those countries, and they were seeking Americanization, for example, on par with what you're saying. You couldn't just put an overlay on. You have to draw out the true character of the of the culture and the history in order to shape where it's going to go. So it makes sense. I can understand where there are some very appealing things that a country would want to in terms of emulating aspects of Singapore, but you can't, you're right. You just can't transfer all of that. There's too much and it's impossible. And it really wouldn't be true to that particular culture either.
Yeah.
Well, let's move to a different range of topic. Let's talk a bit about what you see happening in the world today. What are the large swath themes that you see in terms of the big picture of what's happening in our world? Let's leave out specific politics and COVID-19 right now. This is being recorded in the midst of the phase two of the COVID-19 pandemic in August of 2020. So if someone's listening to this or watching this 6 months from now, I'd like to think that they're seeing things a little differently. But tell us about what you see happening in the world in terms of big picture geopolitics. And then we'll go into investment and opportunity as well from there.
I think that one of the defining themes of the past several years and what will be a defining theme in coming years is that the United States is losing its position of dominance in global politics, economics, currency, you name it. When you look at infrastructure, when you look at alliances around the world and the way the United States has in recent years walked away from them, those alliances and those sorts of friendships between countries that have been cultivated over decades, those were why the United States was able to remain at the head of the table. And that's changing. And, you know, whether that's a good thing, a bad thing, whatever that means, we'll see. But I think that you can also see how it extends to other realms. And when you look at one of the reasons that the United States has economically been so dominant for so long is that it's been a magnet of talent around the world. You go anywhere in the world and still over the past few years, so many people dream of going to the United States, and the United States can afford to pick and choose who it wants to come into the country. I don't think that many people really recognize how unusual that is. Most countries, people can't wait to leave. And there's a relatively small number of countries that people actually want to go to. And that's really made the United States in so many ways the hotbed of innovation and driven growth. Now, something that over the past, it's around 3 years, when you look at the number of working age people in the United States, mm-hmm. that's a very important indicator, because as soon as that figure starts to fall or flatten, then you have to wonder where economic growth is coming from, right? Because economic growth comes from two things: more people creating stuff, or those same people being more efficient in creating stuff, productivity gains. Mm-hmm. If an economy doesn't see growth in one of those two things, or either of those factors, then growth flattens. Then we have a completely different sort of economic picture. And over the past few years, we've actually seen that growth flattening in the US. I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's people leaving the workforce, if it's reduced immigration. But that's actually a key statistic, I think, that is underappreciated. And it kind of harks back to a big theme that one of the most interesting things, I think, of looking at the world is demographics. Demographics plays such an important role in how economies develop and evolve. And you look at the demographics of so much of Europe, from much of the former Eastern Bloc to Italy, to Spain, actually. And you look at how the natural born population is declining, and you look at how the population is aging. And you have to wonder, where are all the people going to come from who are going to drive growth in those economies? And you have a preview in Japan. Japan's economy has been virtually stagnant for, 20 years?
Correct, yeah.
And I think that, I mean, just to get back to your bigger picture question, I think that looking at the evolving demographics of the United States will say a whole lot about the direction of that economy and whether it continues to grow, actually outperform relative to so many other developed economies. Just looking back at the United States and the dollar also, when you look at the US dollar and the foreign currency reserve status, historically, that doesn't usually last too much more than a century. Mm-hmm. And for the United States, it's actually lasted a bit more than a century. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to end at some point. Clearly will, right? All empires end. It's just a question of whether they end on your watch or that of your kids or their kids. I guess the question is, you know, the other sort of main theme of the past few years has certainly been the United States and China getting at each other's throats. And the question is, well, will China be able to take that proverbial head seat at the table? And I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon for kind of an odd reason, just the soft power of the United States. And the soft power is that draw of people. That's why people know everybody. You know, what is the first language that most people in the world want to learn after their own? It's English. What kind of movies do people watch? They're made in Hollywood. Again, where do people want to go? They want to go to the United States. It's kind of like, you know, Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has so much goodwill on its balance sheet just because it's Coca-Cola. Everybody wants a Coke. And why? You know, it's just the way it's always been. Will that be forever? Probably not. And the United States has this incredible soft power. And that, I think, is one of the main reasons that, you know, my kids and their kids will, if they hold American passports, they'll still be okay in the world. Sure, but I think that, I mean, it's very clear that position of dominance is slowly ebbing. And I think that's one of the defining themes, because then you look at the countries that are taking its place. Are they taking its place? Is it bits and pieces of the dominance? Military? Is it economic? Is it geopolitical? Is it some emerging markets? Is it China? Is the EU going to get its act together and be able to really have a unified voice at that global table? Perhaps it will. Perhaps it will have a more unified voice than sort of the mishmash that is emanating from the United States right now.
I find your comment on soft power very interesting, since it's a, you know, in your comparison to Coca-Cola, in terms of Coca-Cola is power of, is a brand, but you're right. It's going to be hard to replicate for another country to develop such soft power, but that may very well come in a future century or in 50 years from now. But I can't imagine people flocking to China certainly not in the near future as a place to live and that they want to thrive. Like I have friends that are still moving to the United States. It baffles me, but I do understand it is a soft power. You're absolutely right. And I understand what appeals. And I love that these are entrepreneurs who they typically find their niche here. But you're right. The future. We can't hold on to it for forever. And it does appear currently that there's the decline is more obvious now. I think the decline has been there for quite some time.
Yes.
Yeah. I like your approach, Kim, and that, because often I'm reading, you know, the theories of, you know, what current, they focus on the currency typically, but then, or they may focus on geopolitics as well. Anyway, let's keep having you speak. It's much more interesting. What else are you seeing in the world today?
I think that to hark back a little bit more to the what's going on between the United States and China, I think that you sort of look ahead and what is unfolding there. I think you do see sort of two tech worlds and a big wall between them. Just because the two can't really coexist, and they're not going to be able to. And that has a lot of implications for how we communicate and how we distribute information and how we collect information and how we use information. I think part of that is a lot of countries are going to have to decide which side they're on. And the under the radar of I think a lot of people, China has made enormous inroads into Latin America, into Africa, even into parts of Europe. And this is China's way of developing its own sort of soft power. Mm-hmm. It's through, you know, kind of what I did in Kyrgyzstan, right? It's through sprinkling money, sprinkling people, and making investments. And I think I think a lot of the countries that people in the West kind of assume will be on, quote unquote, the side of the Americans or on the side of the Europeans may well not be, because the rest of the world has to look at which side of the bread, of their bread it's buttered on, or whatever that expression is. And if China is the number one investor in Brazil or the number one buyer of exports, Brazil is going to say, wait a second, you know, yeah, we're kind of similar to, you know, we feel kind of cultural common space with the Europeans, certainly, and the Americans. But on the other hand, what's the hand that's feeding us? And I think that that's something that we forget about in a lot of emerging markets. What I always like to do is when I'm visiting a new place is to find to look at how many Chinese restaurants there are, right? Because everybody likes to eat their own food. And you know that if you go to, Colombo, the capital of Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. and there are a boatload of Chinese restaurants, and there are far more. I was there last there 2 years ago. There were far more than there were 8 years ago when I first got there. And Chinese investment is flooding in Sri Lanka, and it's a big political issue domestically. And there are all sorts of issues about how China is trying to use that to gain domestic leverage and take control of, it's just a little island in the Indian Ocean, but in terms of shipping lanes, it's incredibly important. But that writ large, when you look at the Belt Road effort, you look at everything else that China is doing, and that's soft power in a different sort of way. And I think that the one thing that we sometimes don't appreciate is that countries learn, and China is slowly learning about how to be much more fluent in that sort of soft power. And they have their own Hollywood studio now. And so many people in China are learning English. And there are a lot of structural issues in terms of the politics, in terms of freedom of movement, and not to mention that the government is still in name a communist government. But over time, all of that is going to change, and China will become much more but much better equipped to address other countries in the world and to draw them to their side for future investment, for economic purposes, geopolitics. So on the one hand, you have the United States, which is so large and established, and it's really getting by on sort of past glory. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you have a nation of 1.4 billion people that is, in some ways, it's clueless in how it's propaganda and how it portrays and presents itself, but it's learning so fast. And it has been learning, and it has been making those long-term investments in countries that are just, have slipped off the radar of the United States.
You'd think that they could learn from the past several hundred years of colonization that preceded the North America and its colonization, long, you know, for many, many centuries before, to put a new face to what they're doing. Fascinating. Well, where do you see opportunities for large swaths? Where do you see the opportunities in the world as well, and investment as well?
You know, I think one of the most exciting things, I think, and also most straightforward things, is to look at what sorts of companies and services and industries exist in developed markets, and then look at emerging and frontier markets and say, but wait a second, that doesn't exist here yet. Why not? And sometimes there are good reasons, because people aren't rich enough to partake of these sorts of services, but you know that they're going to evolve over time. What I'm talking about is, I think one of the most interesting frontier market is Bangladesh. And I was there a few years ago, and I went to the friend who was showing me around. We went to a sushi restaurant. And it was in the middle of downtown Dhaka, and Bangladesh, has 150 million, 160 million people. So it's about half the population of the United States, and they're all packed into a country that is the size of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And Bangladesh on Dhaka on almost every quality of life and survey, Dhaka comes in either last or second to last after Baghdad. It is an incredibly polluted, difficult, awful place to live, but it's been growing. The country's been growing at 8% per year for the past 15 years, and it's still dreadfully poor, and it is so inefficient and corrupt, but it's still growing that fast. So it's the sort of place you look at and you think, well, what if they changed three things for the better? And then what would happen? What could happen to growth? What could happen to the potential of this country? Could just explode through the roof. So to get back to my sushi restaurant, the sushi restaurant catered to maybe the wealthiest 1%, right? But a country of 150 million, 160 million people, that's actually a pretty large demographic. And all of those people are going to live in Dhaka or nearby. And they're all dying for sushi because so many of them travel, or sure, so many of them came from, they lived in Vancouver and then they came over to Dhaka because of a family business or whatever. So there were virtually no sushi restaurants in Dhaka. And this one, the wife of the son of a big shoe plant had come home to, run the family business and said, gosh, I'm going to start a sushi restaurant. And it was terrible sushi, but the business exploded just because there was nobody else doing that. So that's a long-winded way of saying it. A lot of markets have so much opportunity just because the services, the things that people expect in developed markets that exist. At some point, people in Dhaka are going to say, okay, I'm going to go to the IKEA to buy a bookcase. Now, I don't know how you get a bookcase now in Dhaka, but it's certainly not at the local IKEA. But someday that's going to be a huge market. And I think that finding those sorts of industries, those sorts of sectors is a fantastic opportunity. It does often require, obviously, there's no listed sushi restaurant in Dhaka. You can't buy the stock. It does require you to be there, or it requires you to have a very good local partner. But I think that's the sort of opportunity that is always most interesting to me. And that really takes a lot of what I think Obers does is finding those sorts of local partners and saying, okay, what is the sort of service? What is the gap that exists here that a somewhat adventuresome set of investors can help fill? Just to step back, looking at portfolio investment and other opportunities, I tend to focus on markets, on sectors, on countries that are where the perception doesn't match the reality, and where concerns and fears are just overblown. I think one of those places right now is some segments of the stock market in India. And you look at the Indian stock market, it's done very well. It's kind of similar though to the S&P 500. You have a small number of large caps that have gone through the roof, and then you have the vast majority of the listed market of mid and smaller cap stocks that have gone nowhere or fallen. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the macro picture, India is kind of the other big country that we forget to talk about after China. And it is incredibly complicated and messy. And it has a leader who is widely perceived as being racist, or certainly on the doorstep of that. But I think that India is a sort of country that just plods along, and it's never going to generate 10% GDP growth like China did for two decades, but it'll plod along in a way that is a whole lot more than a lot of certainly international investors expect.
Mm-hmm.
Or anticipate in this valuation in terms of the level of attention that has been focused on smaller caps. I think that's just an exciting opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Let's focus on your investment strategy, because you have developed your own personal strategy over the course of your career. and then we'll launch into looking at some of the markets that appeal to you. But what, how would you describe your investment strategy?
You know, I think that one of the big problems of how we even talk about this sort of thing is that people tend to think of investment strategy and diversification in strictly financial terms. And to me, if you ignore all your other sorts of assets, you're only going to get yourself in trouble. Now, what I'm talking about is your education and your experience, the languages you speak, the passports you hold, where your network is, because all of that, you know, over a lifetime, that's, for many people, that's worth far more than their portfolio investments or their real estate or whatever. I think it makes a whole lot of sense to really take a sort of meta view of your portfolio. So, you know, where do I know people? Where can I develop relationships, investment opportunities, work? Where could I live? Because that sort of macro, I call it macro diversification, you know, taking a macro view of diversification, that can drive a whole lot more value over the course of a lifetime. So, for example, so many investors in the United States, they tend to view everything through the prism of what is happening in the United States. And that's where they hold their money. They hold their money in US banks, in US currency. They look at US securities. They only speak English. And not only are they missing out on opportunities elsewhere in the world, they're also exposing themselves to a whole lot of risks. Because for whatever Americans do, people in other countries do all the time. So they say, well, I hold, you know, Russian real estate, Russian stocks, Russian currency. I'm perfectly, well, diversified. Then the entire Russian economy goes to hell in a handbasket. And their net worth has, you know, been cut by 2/3 in real terms. In the United States, we've been very lucky. We haven't had that sort of monumental collapse in asset prices that actually countries all over the world have seen. But I think that it's a mistake for investors, especially in the United States, to not take advantage of the opportunities to look elsewhere and to really expand. It's exciting. It's a wonderful thing to go to different places to explore, to understand. I know that we see this very similarly, of course.
Well, yeah, you're plugging Obrus over and over and over again. I don't know how many first languages there are amongst our group, and thinking about the network of investors around the world and the travel and all of those pieces that you're describing as assets, that's what describes us. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about you and how you view the world.
I think it's, you know,
keep plugging us.
Certainly not even my intention. but it is... you know, I think from a risk diversification perspective, first of all, and secondly, just because it can lead to so many opportunities that you never conceive of. And third, it is the direction of the world, right? Because what we were talking about earlier in terms of the predominance of the United States, you know, in most countries, the assumption is not that you grow up in the country and you stay there and you rarely leave the country and you only think in that country's currency and everything else. In Singapore, Singapore's tiny, you know, you could fit the entire country inside the beltway of Washington, D.C. But the sort of perspective that people have, they go abroad for long weekends and they go to university in Australia and they have kids in the U.S. And it's just the world is kind of a platter. Mm-hmm. And that can... lead to opportunities, as I said, it can lead to risk diversification opportunities and lead to a much richer life than if you only think of your home country as sort of the home base for everything.
And that's also very different. What you're describing is very different than sitting in your home country and investing, say, in the Russian stock market or having someone pick stocks for you or investing in a private equity company, that you're actually building it from the ground up, that you're more educated, more informed of what your investment choices are because you're building it on what you know or what others that you respect know. big difference there.
No, I think that, yes, it's one thing to invest in foreign securities, but and that's fantastic, foreign currencies. But I think it is another thing to, you know, it's kind of smacks of self-help psychobabble to invest in yourself. But, you know, I think that the kids today who are learning another language, who are spending time abroad, who can fit into and slip into other countries, other ways of thinking, will be in such a better position. And it matters more. It matters more than it did 20 years ago, 40 years ago, just because the United States is going to be less dominant over time.
Sure. Well, I'm thinking of a couple of days ago, we were speaking about where your kids are going to school, the international schools. And I've encountered the international schools in multiple countries and just love the makeup of what your kids are going to have for their friends when they're our age, their friends all over the planet. And I think that's the case for us, for each of us as well. And for a lot of our listeners and viewers that are very well established globally.
Yeah, very much so. I think that if you can just slide seamlessly from one country, one culture, have a friend who's, you know, in India and then switch over to someone who's in, you know, suburban DC, and it all, I think that if it all kind of just fits together in your brain and you don't have these sort of strict, okay, this is American and this is this, but it's all kind of like, all right, everybody. And you communicate on that level. I think that's, to me, that's sort of the height of it. That takes a lifetime to cultivate, because then you also see your investment opportunities and your lifetime opportunities and that sort of, through that sort of prism.
So part of your role with Stansberry is, I believe, is directing your readers towards investment. What areas have you been focusing on lately in terms of where you see investment potential based on the viewpoint that you just, or your perspective that you just described?
Well, I think that, I mean, what I mentioned earlier in terms of public equity, I mentioned India. Mm-hmm. I think that the one of the most interesting things happening as a consequence of the coronavirus around the world is the shift toward working from home. And what I'm saying is certainly nothing revolutionary, but that increasingly companies will say, you know what, you don't have to come into the office. I think then there's going to be an entire generation of people who says, gosh, I can, as long as I'm in a similar sort of time zone, I can work wherever I want. And I think that will open up, I don't know, you look at all of Latin America and you look at opportunities to live in parts of Mexico, in Colombia, and be in the same time zone or very similar time zone as the Eastern Seaboard. I think a lot of people that will become a much more viable option. And I think that obviously not everyone there, it needs to be in certain places, and Mexico, even to Americans, still is a big, scary, dangerous place. So we're talking about very selective sorts of situations. But I think that countries that can offer a 60% of the infrastructure and living experience, we'll see a huge boom everywhere from Panama to Tulum in Mexico to parts of Colombia. That's just one thought. I think that in terms of bigger picture opportunity, I mentioned India. I think that when you actually, Russia, I lived in Russia for 9 years and I was I worked for a few investment banks there, ran a hedge fund there for a while. That is a country that has dramatically underperformed for a very, very long time, just because the politics are sclerotic and it's kind of stuck in a different era still. And there are pockets of innovation. But they're stifled or they leave. It's a, you know, Google was founded by, co-founded by a Russian guy in Silicon Valley, not in Russia. Very good reason for that. Mm-hmm. But Russia is fascinating because it's cyclical. it's hugely cyclical. So as long as you choose the right spot in the commodity cycle, because the economy is so commodities oriented, and you choose the right sort of company that's not going to rip off shareholders, it can be a fascinating place. And for that same sort of reason, one of my favorite markets actually is Argentina. And Argentina is at the far end of the spectrum of cyclicality. And you look at some of the traded securities and they go literally up tenfold based on the point in the cycle. That is the commodity cycle, but more so the debt cycle. And Argentina is so poorly run. It's just been disastrous. It's a wonderful, wonderful country, but it's so poorly run. And the there you look at some of the banks, you look at some of the power utilities, and if you can time it right, you can make just a mountain of money there, just by looking at the cycle. What else?
What about Iran? I know that that's something that's been on your mind. So tell us about how you see that, see Iran in term, from an investment perspective.
You know, I think Iran has the potential to be kind of like what we were talking about, Uzbekistan, only times five. I've only been to Iran once, several years ago. And it's weird because it's so closed off. It's actually similar to, I mean, you can really see the analogs with Uzbekistan. It was so closed off from so much of the rest of the world. And there's a population that is dynamic, smart, but cannot really do business with so much of the rest of the world. And the day that the, it sounds very naive, but the day the politics are sort of resolved around all of that, Iran will be a fascinating booming market. And I think it's, you know, what is interesting is when a country does open up like that. And I know some of the opportunities in Uzbekistan have been from just people going in and, you know, whether it's a sushi restaurant or whatever it is, saying, gosh, you know, no one's done this, let's do this. The challenge in Iran or Uzbekistan or North Korea, the day that changes, will be to know the right people in the right position who aren't going to rip you off, who can help you figure out the best way to invest in those sorts of of opportunities.
All right, let's move on to a new topic, and that is, where do you see the puck moving in emerging and frontier markets?
I think the well, I did mention Bangladesh. I think that it will move to those markets that have a critical mass of population. So there's a suitably large workforce and a suitably large domestic consumption base. And that's kind of obvious, right? That's one of the reasons that Kyrgyzstan isn't going anywhere. There aren't enough people there. That's one of the reasons that Vietnam has thrived so much in recent years, because there's a large enough domestic consumer base. And also there are enough people that they can draw investment and they can make stuff, so they can be a lower cost option for industries that used to be based in China. And you do see some of that in Bangladesh. Bangladesh makes the second most apparel of any country in the world after China. It's a question of exploiting that. I think that the puck moves to those countries. You know, that's a good question. You always want to find the countries that are royally screwed up, but are making just enough improvements so it goes from absolutely horrific to kind of bad. I think Russia does have the potential to be that sort of place. There would need to be a change in leadership, and we could be having the same conversation 10 years from now, because I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
I think it's a few more years than that that we could have that conversation.
Yeah. Yes. I think the puck moves to, you look at Brazil and how poorly Brazil is being run right now. And all you have to do is look at, you know, not to focus on it, but look at the response to COVID-19. And that's been absolutely disastrous for Brazilians, and disastrous for the investment environment. And Brazil is so extraordinarily wealthy in terms of natural resources, an enormous population base. I think that the China will continue to grow, but China has been so difficult when you look at how so many multinationals have tried to crack the Chinese market and not been able to. That's just going to continue to be a theme. Mm-hmm. In a way, that's because it's a market that is too large and doesn't need external investment. It's either stolen all the ideas, or it's gotten the ideas from investors and apply them itself. Sure. Whereas you don't have that quite that. You're not going to see something similar in a place like Vietnam.
What keeps you awake at night? And then the follow-up to that is, what gives you peace in this current era?
You know, what I think keeps me awake at night is the thought that there are people in positions of power and influence who don't have in mind the greater good, and who are ultimately selfish and don't really care about others. You know, I think a lack of empathy in the world has been the source of so much destruction and ill will and death. It sounds almost silly, but empathy is really what connects us as a human race, and that there are people in positions of power without that. I'm thinking of the United States. I'm thinking of, we're talking about Brazil. There's so many places. And I think that's where problems arise, because as soon as that happens, then everything else breaks down. Mm-hmm. Then you're not thinking about the greater good. You're thinking only about yourself or your immediate surroundings. What I find some reassurance of, though, is that there is, we were talking a little bit about cyclicality earlier. All of this runs in cycles, right? And what we're so afraid of today and what is so bad today, you know, give it a couple of years and it'll all change. It's so unusual that you see a structural change in anything. And you do, you know. Someday the dollar will no longer be a global reserve currency. That will be a big structural change. But you can kind of put your finger on a handful of structural changes every generation that really matter. So I think what I find reassurance in is that everything evolves and reverts to the mean, and everything more or less ticks over.
What do you expect for your, you have teenagers, what do you expect the world to look like for them when they're in their 20s and 30s and 40s?
And when we're in our...
Yes.
20s and 80s, right? I don't know. I think the world will be faster. Everything will... It's so much faster today than it was, you know, when I was a teenager, when we were teenagers. You know, back then, when you wanted to make an international phone call, it's like, whoa, I can make an international phone call. This is like, whew. Now my kids see nothing and talking to their friends in Singapore. I think that'll just be times 10 over in coming years. I think that, you know, I think globalization, there's so much talk now about the death of globalization with the United States and China and trade wars. I think it'll be a different sort of globalization, but it'll still be there. It might be a fragmented one, but it'll still exist. And that's partly why I believe so firmly that diversifying all of your assets globally makes so much sense, just because countries cannot thrive on their own. They need the rest of the world. And I think that the way that we... I think the way that we think of money is, and value is also going to change. I think we're seeing we talk about millennials and how they don't want to work too hard, and the stereotype I think is damaging, but sometimes apt. But I think it does reflect a more holistic view of what matters to people. And I think that when we look in hindsight at our generation and the previous one, there was much more of a focus on hitting certain financial benchmarks and less of an interest in living a fuller life I think people are going to concentrate much more on that. I think my kids will, for better or for worse. Maybe they'll work less. Hopefully they'll work more efficiently. But I think that there will be a much better balance. And that may well come through, you know, people work from home and they say, wait a second, I can balance my life much better. I can be a much more a happier person and think of my assets, not of just money in the bank, but I took this fantastic trip. I had this great dinner. I don't know. Maybe that sounds kind of snowflakey, but I think it.
No, you know, I don't think that's all that different than what those of us in our 40s and 50s are wanting to achieve now, at least my circle of relationships, and that I can understand where the millennials and whatever the next generation after that see how older generations have worked, and really are cogs in a wheel. And no one wants that. But if you're in the middle of that, you don't necessarily see it. My circle of relationships, most of us want to be smarter with our time and let our investments and our assets work for us so that we can thoroughly enjoy life. And I think the goal is very similar to what you just described of millennials, that their goal is to work less. I don't think our goal is to work less, it's to work smarter so that our assets work for us. Unfortunately, that generation don't have a lot of assets that are marketable assets that they can grow significantly. Interesting perspective. I think I could ask you a lot more questions. We could dig deeper on a lot of things, and I think that's going to come in the near future. Look forward to that, Kim. I appreciate your time. I wish you well as you're getting settled into Dublin, and now that you can get out and actually experience the summer of Ireland, will be well. I look forward to being in touch with you very soon. And thanks very much for speaking today. And I'm sure our viewers will have appreciated this interview. So thank you.
Thank you, James.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us today. There's a great deal to glean from Kim's experience in the world and his expertise in investing. What stands out the most to me is how we view and experience the world shapes us as investors. I particularly appreciate Kim's emphasis on macro diversification in investing. I also appreciate his lens to consider how and why markets and industries have greater or less potential. There's really a lot to consider there. There are many strategic opportunities beyond what we call home, what we know. It is our goal in Obris to introduce you to people like Kim, from whom you can glean as you consider expanding your portfolio and your experience in the world. Many of our viewers and listeners have built their portfolios in a similar manner. Perhaps the best way to end this podcast is to ask you, the viewers and listeners, the same questions. How do you view the world? Where do you see opportunities? If you are one who, like Kim and me, benefit from macro diversification, great. If not, consider how you can expand your worldview and benefit from doing so. I also recommend that you consider Obris. Head over to obrisinvest.com. That's obrisinvest.com to learn about our investor group. We are welcoming new members at this time. Come to an Obris event as well. There's no better way to get to know us than through our events. Check out our website for details on the next Obris Global Investor Summit. Our members and guests are an amazing group of self-made and accomplished investors. They come from 15 countries and a wide variety of professions. We share the common pursuit of surrounding ourselves with great people in great places and gaining significant returns in investing. Thanks for joining me this week.